content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft reading from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, Gambling Enters the Family Zone by Christine Emba. You were always meant to lose money at Dave & Buster's. Maybe it would be Pac-Man or the milk jug toss, maybe to the claw machine and its confoundedly ungraspable stuffies, maybe, and perhaps most painfully, to several middling cheeseburger sliders and an oversized margarita as you watched a football game on a towering wall of TVs. This past spring, however, the restaurant and arcade chain announced a new way to help people part with their money. Gambling. Of course, the company doesn't call it gambling. Dave & Buster's has taken as a partner the technology firm Lucra, which specializes in gamification software to facilitate what Lucra's chief operating officer has said are real money contests for its customers. Through Dave & Buster's app, the chain's loyalty members will be able to place cash wagers on the so-called skill-based games they play, skee-ball, basketball shootouts, and the like, in what the companies characterize as an elevation of friendly competition. Why not let the arcade help you keep track of that $5 skee-ball bet before your ability to calculate washes away in a Bud Light haze? But then again, why should it be involved? The Dave & Buster's slogan, Eat, Drink, Play, Watch, invokes a lighthearted fun of corporate outings and kids' birthday parties. But make no mistake, the company's new initiative is to move into commercialized betting, a symptom of a larger and troubling trend. Suddenly, gambling seems to be everywhere. This sort of vice creep, a societal normalization of what used to be seen as unsavory habits, gambling, smoking marijuana, watching porn, is accelerated by people's addiction to devices, in this case giving casual bettors the tools to become compulsive wagerers and easing the way for gambling to become a consistent part of your life. For most American history, gambling was generally frowned upon, assumed to sully the integrity of the sports on which people wagered and the souls of the gamblers themselves. In 1934, the New York Times quoted ministers of New York churches denouncing gambling as a, quote, leprous touch on sport, end quote, antisocial, corrupting, character-destroying, a danger to young people. In 1995, the Public Broadcasting Service was still hosting debates about whether allowing public gambling would teach the wrong moral lessons. Gambling also used to be much more difficult to access. Before the internet, you had to go somewhere to place a bet, to a racetrack, a bookie, a casino. The moral stigma and the relegation of gambling to specific and somewhat tawdry locations made it clear that the practice was not something to be entered into without caution. Over the past several decades, though, American society has lost some of its fervor for policing morality. See, for instance, the efforts to mitigate the harms of drug use as opposed to prescribing individuals' activities. Governments in particular are declining to prohibit what used to be seen as vices, especially when, as with gambling, taxing them brings home revenue. Although regulated state lotteries have existed since 1964, and the first Native American-run casino opened in 1979, a significant cultural shift took place in 2018 when the Supreme Court in Murphy v. National Collegiate Athletic Association invalidated the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act. The decision allowed individual states to legalize commercial sports betting, kicking off a boom that has yet to subside. Now you can't turn on a football game or drive down a highway without being encouraged to make a wager. DraftKings and FanDuel, online sites whose ads blanket TV, radio, and the internet, launched in the early 2000s as daily fantasy sports platforms, and since Murphy, have recast themselves as smartphone-friendly sports betting destinations. A herd of other companies have followed suit, seeking to cash in. The online sports betting industry took in $10.4 billion in revenue last year alone, an approximately 50% increase since 2022. Today, 30 states and Washington, D.C. allow mobile sports betting, according to the American Gaming Association, and three have legislation pending. Some people might argue that this is simply the way of the market, and not particularly sinister, because consumers can always choose not to gamble. Technically, that is true, but that reasoning becomes a bit less convincing when you consider the technology most people now carry in their pockets. In a sense, Americans have been training themselves for years to become eager users of gambling tech. Smartphone app design, as it has been amply reported, relies on the variable reward method of habit formation to get people hooked, the same mechanism that casinos use to keep people playing games and pulling levers. When Instagram sends notifications about likes or worthwhile posts, people are impelled to open the app and start scrolling. When sports betting apps send push alerts about fantastic parlays, people are coaxed into placing one more bet. Smartphones have thus habituated people to an expectation of stimulation and potential reward at every moment. You're constantly surrounded by the ability to change your neurochemistry by a simple click. Timothy Fong, a UCLA psychiatry professor and a co-director of the university's gambling studies program, told me, "There's this idea that we have to have excessive dopamine with every experience in our life." The frictionless ease of mobile sports betting takes advantage of this. It has become easy, even ordinary, to experience the, quote, excitement, end quote, of gambling everywhere. Bet on the election. Bet on how long your coworker stays employed in a job. What kind of grades your kids get when grandma dies, Fong said. I hate to be so flippant about it, but that's exactly what apps are priming people to do. It's to say that any unknown outcome in your life, we can gamify. We can make it more interesting. Both customers and companies building tools to make betting easier might argue that there are upsides to the new gambling tech. It's better that we don't have mobbed-up bookies at the racetrack breaking thumbs, and it's not terrible that, via taxes and fees, governments can make a buck from the gambling industry too. But gambling isn't harmless, which is why it is subject to regulation. Some state officials are already scrutinizing the Dave and Buster's plan. For one thing, gambling is addictive, the only non-substance addiction disorder recognized in the American Psychiatry Association's DSM-5, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. For another, gambling addiction can have enormous ramifications: extreme debt, depression, broken relationships, crises that may not be visible until someone is deep in the hole. Because the consequences of gambling typically don't manifest as physical symptoms, unlike the health effects of alcoholism, drug use, or smoking, society is already behind on tracking and addressing gambling's harms and preparing for the ramifications of its extended reach. Leah Noer, the director of the Center of Gambling Studies at Rutgers University's School of Social Work, put it to me this way. Think about the fact that there are all these regulatory agencies collecting data for substances. Look at the opioid epidemic, the hospitals, all these points of entry were collecting data, which is how public health officials realized that something was wrong. But there is no federal office overseeing gambling addiction and no federal organization funding the development of evidence-based treatment, according to the nonprofit National Council on Problem Gambling. Among federal officials, gambling is not on anyone's radar as a serious public health concern, Noer said. Perhaps more insidiously, gambling changes the culture. Compare a friendly game of Hot Shots basketball at Dave and Buster's with one in which cash is on the line. Once money is involved, the dynamics change, not always predictably, but rarely in a positive direction. Dave & Buster's has said that it plans to limit the size of bets allowed, although it has yet to announce a cap. Lucra has said that the average bet on its platform is $10. And even if there remains some lingering shred of stigma around gambling, legalization puts an enormous amount of advertising is likely to diminish it. The press release from Lucra is almost admirably forthright admission about what the company has called social wagering. Lucra's approach will help to destigmatize cash-based competition by evolving it into a fun, friendly, and social experience. This approach is also likely to introduce gambling to younger audiences. Lucra says that it uses third-party services to verify people's identity and age, and that its gaming products are available only to customers age 18 and older, a statement Nowher scoffed at when I asked her about it. "That illusion is completely dead," she said. "Once you move everything to an online venue and your smartphone, there is absolutely no way to police whether it's a 5-year-old placing bets or a 55-year-old. For companies courting new audiences, that's probably part of the appeal. Commercialized gambling makes most of its profit from people who are heavy users, not casual ones, and the industry wants to draw them in earlier and earlier. We absolutely know that the younger you are when you start gambling, that increases risk of gambling addiction," Fong of UCLA told me. "We also know that when you do it more frequently, that absolutely increases the rate of addiction." Oh, sure, just for fun. Dave & Buster's patrons may soon be encouraged to start placing casual bets on games with their friends on the company's app. If they do, they should remember that the same calculus applies on their phone as in traditional gambling. When you throw down the money, you're less likely to fill your own pockets than you are to boost someone else's bottom line. Social wagering may be sold as a way to make experiences more exciting, but the house, as ever, is bound to come out on top. Today's second article is from the science section. "A Major Climate Threat Could Be Disastrous for Birds," by Kylie Moore. Last summer, Carrie Brown Cornarens spent 10 minutes every week observing birds in her Los Angeles backyard and at nearby Griffith Park. Brown Cornarens, a ceramicist with a background in graphic design and animation, looked and listened closely for birds amid the coastal sagebrush, scrub, oak, and walnut trees. She was already collecting data for a local raptor study, and she liked the idea of learning even more about birds and their behavior. "Just 10 minutes a week. That's all it takes for volunteers to help scientists such as Olivia Sanderfoot, a postdoctoral scholar at UCLA, understand how birds respond to wildfire smoke." Brown Cornarens is one of more than 300 volunteers who participated in Project Phoenix, a joint initiative of UCLA and the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County, led by Sanderfoot. Following a successful pilot season in California last year, the effort is expanding into Oregon and Washington this summer, with data collection to run from July 1st through November 30th. "Birds are more sensitive to toxic gases and particle pollution than humans are. They're sometimes enlisted as early indicators of poor air quality." That's where the expression, "a canary in a coal mine," comes from. "But little is known about the specific effects of wildfire smoke and its fine particulates on bird health and behavior. A 2021 U.S. Geological Survey study of radio-collared tule geese suggested that smoke pushed at least 4 birds hundreds of miles out of their way. On average, the quartet's members flew an additional 470 miles to go around the smoke, more than doubling their previous year's migration time. The lead author, Corey Overton, said that the handful of waterfowl also detoured last year around the smoke plumes from Canada's wildfires. "Longer migrations require more energy, which could hinder reproduction or even lead to death. As wildfires grow in frequency and severity due to climate change and forest mismanagement, birds and other species are being forced to adapt. Smoke impacts millions of animals, and yet we know so little about what their natural defenses are against that, says Jamie Cornelius, a biologist at Oregon State University, who has collaborated with the Project Phoenix team. Air pollution from wildfires is eroding the improvements in air quality seen since the passage of the 1970 Clean Air Act. Although summer smoke doesn't typically coincide with most breeding seasons or spring migrations, that could change as fire seasons lengthen. There's an urgency here to figure out more about what's going on and how we can help birds in this tumultuous time, Sanderfoot says. Sanderfoot is studying behavioral changes in 20 species of backyard birds, including crows, song sparrows, and two common hummingbirds. No one really knows what to expect. Birds might hunker down, limiting their activity in order to minimize smoke exposure, or they might become more active, increasing their preening and feeding. They may show signs of stress, such as loss of appetite, or changes in vocalization, as in singing more or less. They might even exhibit aggressive behavior. Or they might leave the area entirely in search of cleaner air. Smoke might also attract other species, such as the black-backed woodpecker, which feed on the insects that are drawn to the smoke. Project Phoenix volunteers are asked to record all the birds they see or hear during a 10-minute survey each week at the same location. Knowing which birds are around, when, and in what numbers will indicate where they are and aren't when it's smoky. As the project progresses, researchers will use that basic information to learn more about different species' behavioral responses. Last year, Project Phoenix volunteers captured 170 hours worth of data at more than 320 different sites throughout California. Volunteers can sign up at any point during the study window. The project has compiled resources to help novices identify birds. No previous bird watching experience is required. It was kind of too easy, Brown Cornerin says. I thought, am I missing something? Recruiting volunteers is about more than just collecting data, says Caitlin O'Neill, the communications lead for the project and an undergraduate student at UCLA. We also wanted to introduce birding and the benefits of it to people who maybe had never heard of it or never really thought about getting involved with it before. Sanderfoot hopes to inspire a birder or two along the way. Bird watching, she says, has changed my life in a very powerful, positive way. It's become a meditative practice that has improved her mental health. I just want to share that with other people, she says. In Oregon, Cornelius is trying a different approach to learn more about what birds do when it's smoky outside. Each summer, she travels to the region's smokiest areas to tag and monitor common forest songbirds. Her team assesses the birds' fat and muscle tone and takes blood samples in order to measure stress hormones and immune responses. She also attaches small radio transmitters to finches in order to track the birds and document their heart rate, likely a good indicator for activity levels. As these data accumulate, her lab will use them to understand the physiological and behavioral effects of smoke on birds. The summer of 2023 wasn't particularly smoky in California, so last year's data will serve as a baseline for smokier summers. Even so, Brown Cornerins left her survey sites with a deeper understanding of the world around her. She learned the favorite cache spots of acorn woodpeckers and even found a great horned owl nest. It's learning more intimate things you wouldn't normally pay attention to, Brown Cornerin says. She plans to volunteer with Project Phoenix again this summer, adding more observations to a growing data set. Next, Houston is on a path to an all-out power crisis, by Andrea Valdez. For the 2.2 million people in Houston who lost power after Hurricane Beryl swept through the city, The first question they had was, when will the electricity be back on? The city's utility, CenterPoint Energy, didn't yet have an online outage map to monitor. There was, however, a workaround. The Whataburger app works as a power outage tracker, tweeted a user who goes by the name BBQ Brian, alongside a screenshot of the beloved local fast food chain's location map on its app. It did, helpfully, observatively, track roughly the city's actual outages. Bonus points that it let folks know where to grab a Whata meal. It was a frustrating and dissatisfying solution to what feels like a frustrating and dissatisfying situation Houstonians find themselves in again. Houston bills itself as the energy capital of the world, and it is home to thousands of energy-related companies. Yet, in Texas-sized irony, this is the third time this year that large stretches of the city have gone without power for multiple days. The most troubling part is that Beryl wasn't even that severe. It was a strong Category 1 hurricane, but it wasn't as powerful a storm as Hurricane Ike, which when it hit the city in 2008 was flirting with Category 3 status and left parts of the city without power for weeks. Beryl moved through quickly, unlike Hurricane Harvey, which parked itself over Houston for 4 days in 2017 and dropped several feet of rain. By Gulf hurricane standards, Beryl was pretty modest, and still much of Houston is paralyzed. 5 days after the storm, 854,000 customers still had no power. CenterPoint did eventually release an outage map, and it's a wild visual artifact. Much of the city and surrounding Harris County is highlighted blue, meaning that those areas have been assessed and are waiting to be eventually energized. All this as summer temperatures push into the 90s, with feels-like temps nearing or at triple digits. Moderate storms like Beryl are concerning because they reveal just how fragile Houston's power infrastructure has become. A fierce derecho hit the city on May 16th, cutting off power for nearly 1 million customers. The devastation to the grid was most evident in alarming, widely shared photos of transmission lines toppled and bent like toy pipe cleaners. It took CenterPoint about a week to restore power to most of those affected customers. Then 2 weeks later, on May 28th, a severe thunderstorm hit the city with hurricane-force winds, knocking out power to 325,000. CenterPoint restored service in roughly 2 days. Beryl restoration efforts will take at least a week for some. The utility had returned power to roughly 1.4 million customers by midweek, and CenterPoint said it was aiming to restore 80% of impacted customers by the end of that weekend. These outages obviously mean no power for homes, a huge inconvenience at best and a deadly scenario at worst, but also businesses all over the city have lost millions of dollars and untold hours of productivity. Tons of food have been wasted, both from personal fridges and by local restaurants on slim margins that can probably bounce back from one outage, but maybe not three. Doctor's appointments have been canceled and medical treatments have been delayed. Traffic lights hang dead in the air, compounding car congestion in the country's fourth largest city. Each time the power goes out, lives get put on indefinite hold as people wait for their world to turn back on. All of this, and it's just July. We've only hit B in the hurricane naming conventions. We're still weeks away from the most active hurricane months of August and September in what's predicted to be an above-normal season. Houstonians are, sadly, old hands at this. Lots of people have invested in generators, which have basically become an essential household appliance to power things like fridges and fans and portable AC units. But there has been even issues in getting gas to fill those generators. Gas stations with no power mean inactive pumps. And with limited power in the city, cars are lined up 10, 20, 30 deep at the stations that are functioning. One writer at the Houston Chronicle waited 3.5 hours to fill her tank. I saw some of this pandemonium firsthand when I drove into the city from Austin to accompany my mom to a doctor appointment that ended up, surprise, canceled. On my way, I stopped at a Buc-ee's in Waller, Texas, about 25 miles outside of Houston city limits. Buc-ee's, another beloved Texas institution, this one a chain of gas stations known for shockingly enormous convenience stores and blessedly clean restrooms, was unusually busy. But I had never seen anything like this. Nearly every one of its dozens of gas pumps was servicing a car as people circled the gigantic lot looking for open spots. Its multi-thousand square foot store was teeming with customers. People had driven for miles just for gas and convenience, and maybe a short reprieve in an air-conditioned building. 5 days into the mess, we've entered the part of the weather disaster cycle where politicians, bureaucrats, and company executives are Spider-Man memeing one another. A finger-pointing game has been playing out in the media between Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and County Judge Lena Hidalgo over who reacted to what when. Meanwhile, most of the fire and brimstone rhetoric has been directed at CenterPoint. Why did so many CenterPoint power lines and poles snap so easily? Why wasn't the grid built stronger? And why wasn't vegetation cut away? The Chronicle columnist Chris Tomlinson recently lamented. Somebody tagged an I-10 interpass with the words CenterPointless, with the S's painted as dollar signs. CenterPoint has defended its response to the storm by noting that trees across Greater Houston area also contributed heavily to the outages as they were vulnerable to due to significant freezes, drought, and heavy rain over the past 3 years. It's true that there have been multiple storms, including the devastating winter storm Uri in 2021, which greatly damaged trees and brush across the entire state. But, as many Houstonians have been shouting, CenterPoint and city officials have had years to deal with issues as precarious trees and to bolster Houston's infrastructure for an endless future of hurricanes. As cities across the world adapt to climate crisis, Houston is looking like a worst-case scenario of what happens when infrastructure doesn't evolve to meet the moment. Worse storms will come. Will the city be prepared? We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.